First case is 03-137, State of Ohio versus Nathaniel Jackson. Mr. Lager.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, with the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 8 minutes for rebuttal argument. May it please the court, my name is Dennis Lager, who, along with my co-counsel John Lasko, represent the appellate in this case, Nathaniel Jackson. This is a capital case on direct appeal from the Trumbull County Court of Common Pleas. Facts of this case, Your Honors, indicate that between January of 2001 and December of 2001, the appellant Nathaniel Jackson and the former wife of the deceased in this matter, Robert Fingerhut, the wife Donna Roberts, had engaged in a relationship for a period of a year during the time that Mr. Jackson was incarcerated in the Ohio Department of Corrections at the Lorain Correctional Facility. During this time, the evidence indicates that a relationship was spawned and there was various communications, both in writing and in telephone conversations, which were recorded, which purport to indicate a plan to murder Mr. Fingerhut upon Mr. Jackson's release from the Lorain Correctional Facility, all of which occurred on or about December 10th of 2001. On December 12th of 2001, Ms. Roberts dropped Mr. Jackson off in Youngstown, Ohio. He walked to the Greyhound bus station, where Mr. Fingerhut was the owner and operator of the Greyhound bus station. Conversation ensued regarding the obtaining of a job and also the purchase of some marijuana. Mr. Fingerhut collected Mr. Jackson and drove him to his house for whatever matters they were discussing. At the house, an argument ensued between Mr. Fingerhut and Mr. Jackson. Mr. Jackson alleging that Mr. Fingerhut became insulting, pulled a gun on him in the course and was shot in the finger. In the course of the struggle, Mr. Jackson shot and killed Mr. Fingerhut. Subsequently, Mr. Jackson was indicted for 2 counts of aggravated murder with aggravating circumstance specifications. Trial ensued from October 8th to November 15th of 2001, at which time Mr. Jackson was found guilty of aggravated murder with the aggravating specification and was ordered to a sentence of death. We have submitted 12 propositions of law for the court's consideration in this capital appeal. We will acknowledge that 8 of those propositions, propositions 5 through 12, have previously been litigated before this court and are not subject to argument today, given the fact that the court has ruled on those. We offer those for purposes of preserving the record on appeal and for purposes of federalizing this case. There are 3 issues, however, that we would like to argue, which we believe perhaps justify this court's consideration of overturning the conviction of Mr. Jackson or vacating the sentence of death and remanding for sentence. That would be violations of Mr. Jackson's 6th and 14th Amendment rights by reason of having ineffective assistance of counsel, prosecutorial misconduct, and judicial error, all of which denied procedural due process, right to a fair jury trial, and a 6th Amendment right to effective assistance of counsel. Regarding the effective assistance of counsel, the record establishes in this case the trial counsel, Mr. Lewis and Consul Dane of Trumbull County, were 2 trial counsels who were simply incapable and incompetent to represent a person in a capital litigation. As a matter of fact, these trial counsel were so incompetent, derelict, and deficient in their representation of Mr. Jackson that it was tantamount to having no counsel. It was tantamount to having lay people from the street who would sit at counsel table with Mr. Jackson in the course of this trial.
Counsel, before you go.
Excuse me, go ahead, Jessica.
Before you go further, these 2 attorneys, however, were certified pursuant to rule. Is that correct?
They were certified, Your Honor, all of which I submit based upon this case calls into question the efficacy of the certification process. These 2 gentlemen are people from the record who should no longer be certified and should have no business trying capital cases, and I think the evidence and the record will establish that. For example, these 2 counsel fashioned an entire defense to the capital specifications under the theory that because Donna Roberts owned the vehicle in which Mr. Fingerhut was driving and because she owned the house in which he was residing, that he therefore could not steal the car and commit a robbery, and therefore could not have committed a burglary or trespassed upon the property because he had permission. This court has reviewed that type of argument for the past 23 years. In 1982, State versus Rhodes, 1987, State versus Steffen, 99, State versus Lilly, 2000, State versus O'Neill. The argument and theory that these attorneys fashioned were simply contrary to law, published law. And had they cracked a book or opened a book and read any of these courts' opinions in the last 23 years, they would have known that. To show the incompetence of these lawyers would be by coming before you today and making the argument that this case should be overturned, Your Honors, because Donna Roberts owned the car and Donna Roberts owned the house and therefore could not have committed the offense of robbery and the offense of burglary. If I made that argument to you today, you would have to think that I would be one of the most incompetent capital appellant litigators in the state. And yet, although it's not part of the record, that was the argument that trial counsel encouraged Mr. Lasko and I to make. They still are under that belief that that is an argument. This shows the effect, I mean, the extent of their lack of knowledge and incompetence as capital litigators. Secondly,
does that go to capital litigation or does that go to practicing law and understanding legal theories?
Well, I think it goes to both, Your Honor, because the cases.
How does that relate to the capital specifications?
Well, the capital specifications in this case were the felony murders. And their theory of why they couldn't prove felony murder is that there could be no burglary and there could be no robbery because she owned the house and owned the car and thus gave Mr. Jackson permission to enter upon the property and take the car. That's clearly not consistent with the rulings of this court, as Your Honor knows. And so their failure in this regard would not only go to capital litigation, but would go to any litigation in which these types of issues are raised. It's more exacerbated, however, when we have a capital problem. Further, Your Honors, what the record shows is that throughout this trial, these counsel literally, if not figuratively, sat on their hands in the course of proceedings and failed to make appropriate objections during the course of improper comment by the prosecutor, improper conduct by the prosecutor, and improper rulings by the trial court. For example, in the course of voir dire, the evidence establishes from the record that the prosecutor constantly extracted promises from all 12 impaneled juries that if the aggravated circumstances were greater than the mitigating circumstances, that they would render a verdict of recommending death. That if the proof was beyond a reasonable doubt, they would render a verdict of guilty. The purpose of voir dire, as the court is aware, is to find a fair and impartial jury not tainted by bias and prejudice. And the purpose of capital voir dire is for purposes of having the jury consider aggravating circumstances and mitigating circumstances, not to poll the jury as to whom is going to vote for death, which is exactly what the prosecutor did in this case for all 12 impaneled juries. Not one objection by counsel during the course of that procedure, all of which waives any appellate review except under the doctrine of plain error.
Normally, the prosecutor will go further, and after saying, if you find that there is evidence, as you have just stated, you will find the defendant guilty. However, if there's something missing, you will find not guilty. What was it, a two-part question that was asked during voir dire?
I think the two-part question asked during voir dire was, if there's proof beyond a reasonable doubt, in this case, will you find the defendant guilty? And if the aggravating circumstances outweigh the mitigating circumstances, will you render a verdict for death? And those were the questions that were asked of all of the 12 jurors that were impaneled. It's simply improper to do that. And there was no objection at all during the entire voir dire process by defense counsel, thus waiving our ability to raise that as error other than plain error review by this court. There also was a demonstration by a prosecutor of an attempt to limit and talk about mitigating factors during the course of voir dire. And that Prosecutor Watkins, throughout the voir dire and for 10 of the impaneled, 12 of the 12 impaneled jurors, talked about the mitigating factor of mental disease and defect as possibly being one of the mitigating factors that might justify a life sentence as opposed to a death sentence. And this was offered under the disguised view of, I'm just talking about the kinds of mitigators that may come about. We know from this court's rulings that it is improper to talk about mitigating factors before all of the evidence is before the trier. Furthermore, it's improper to weigh mitigating factors that have not been advanced or addressed by the defendant. And yet the prosecutor was doing this in the course of voir dire, again, all without objection to by defense counsel, which waived error other than plain error. And the purpose of this, of course, was so the prosecutor, as we will show, and as I will indicate when I get to the argument with respect to prosecutorial misconduct, is that the prosecutor wanted to raise the issue of mental disease and defect as a mitigator in final argument, notwithstanding the fact that it was never raised by defense counsel, notwithstanding the fact that defense counsel told them that it wouldn't be raised, and notwithstanding the fact that there was a pretrial ruling by the court that no one could talk about those mitigators not raised by the counsel, and the court could not give instructions not raised by counsel. Counsel made no objection on that. There were inappropriate statements by the prosecutor, such as the aggravating circumstances in this case would be the killing of a homeowner. We know that that's not an aggravating circumstance, but that was a constant theme that was repeated throughout voir dire, all without objection of counsel. And we also know that the record shows that the prosecutor said such things as, even if there's proof beyond a reasonable doubt of mitigating circumstances, you will nonetheless, under the law, render a verdict of death. Those were the kinds of statements being made by the prosecutor in voir dire, all without objection by these counsel. This tainted that jury pool coming into this case. And furthermore, in the court, these letters, this written correspondence between Ms. Roberts and Mr. Jackson, some 280 letters. The letters drafted by Mr. Jackson were offered into evidence in his case. With the predicate of authentication through a handwriting expert. However, the 147-some letters by Ms. Roberts were offered into evidence, all of which purported to establish this conspiracy, this plan to murder, all without any authentication at all, merely upon the testimony that they were discovered in Ms. Roberts' home or in the trunk of her car, again, without any objection by defense counsel, all of which waives error. This is a litany of the lack of representation that defense counsel provided to Mr. Jackson. And I think it shows that they were egregiously deficient.
But the standard is Strickland versus Washington, is it not?
The standard is Strickland versus Washington, Justice O'Donnell.
And that's a two-part test.
Well, it is a two-part test, and
You're demonstrating some ineffectiveness, is what you're trying to establish, I think, with us. But don't you also have to show the outcome would have been different?
Your Honor, I appreciate the question, and I will enjoy the opportunity of having dialogue with you with respect to Strickland. I think Strickland versus Washington is a flawed standard. And I think it's a flawed standard because I think it's contradictory with respect to the standards that are set forth in Strickland, and it results in contradictory decisions and applications. Obviously, under Strickland, the purpose is to determine whether there was deficient performance and then whether there was prejudice resulting from that deficient performance. The standard that you just talked about, Justice O'Donnell, was the standard which says that a defendant must show that there's a reasonable probability that but for counsel's unprofessional errors, the result of the proceeding would have been different. That's the outcome determinative test. And a reasonable probability is a probability sufficient to undermine confidence in the outcome. Now, given that standard, if that's the standard that's to be applied, the problem with that standard in Strickland is it's completely unassailable with respect to any argument that could ever be advanced with respect to ineffective assistance. Noteworthy about that standard, however, written, I believe, by Justice O'Connor, who I think authored the opinion, is that
Not this O'Connor.
Immediately preceding that, in maybe two paragraphs, Justice O'Connor wrote, quote, "We believe that a defendant need not show that counsel's deficient conduct more likely than not altered the outcome in the case. The result of a proceeding can be rendered unreliable and hence the proceeding itself unfair, even if the errors of counsel cannot be shown by a preponderance of the evidence to have determined the outcome. Those standards, I submit, are contradictory, and yet they are there in Strickland. And to show and demonstrate the problems that courts have had with respect to interpreting Strickland, which I've indicated is a flawed standard, is that this court, I believe, respectfully, has had problems interpreting Strickland. In the case of State versus Clifton, 1999, which was a death penalty case, this court initially stated the standard of outcome determinative. Must be a reasonable probability that but for counsel's unprofessional errors, the result of the proceeding would have been different. In a few short sentences after that, this court went on to state, and I quote, contrary to the state's claim, the defendant need not show that but for the error, the trial would have come out differently. This court, in the same case, within three or four paragraphs, used both standards of Strickland, which I submit are contradictory. Thus, the question of which standard we use. If you always want to defeat an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, you can do it with Strickland. If you want to allow an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, you can do it with Strickland. But to show you how illogical Strickland is, the illogical absurdity, is that I said at the outset that these counsel were akin to having no counsel, or akin to having two lay people from the street who could have been just as ignorant about the law as these trial counsel were.
But we've generally drawn a very clear distinction between structural error and procedural error. I mean, structural error is something so fundamental that you're right, it doesn't matter whether you can demonstrate error or not. And I'll have to look at those cases because you are quoting something that may have followed a structural error analysis versus just a procedural error analysis. And those are two very different standards. Was there a distinction between what was quoted in those two statements you've given us?
In Clifton, I can't tell you if there was a distinction between structural and procedural error. And I would acknowledge, Your Honor, that a situation, and I'm bringing an absurd situation before the court to show the lack of logic of Strickland, is that obviously if we forced a capital defendant to go to trial without counsel, that would be a structural defect, and it would be overturned as a Sixth Amendment violation. But under a Strickland analysis of that absurdity, we would say that the defendant need not show that by reason of absence of counsel that altered the outcome of the case. And under Strickland, viewing that absurdity, we could say that but for the absence of counsel, you'd have to show that the outcome would be different. Applying Strickland to that absurdity just doesn't offer any logical results. And I use that merely
don't
as
an... Don't we have to have some sort of test like that? I mean, this is not a perfect world. You have counsel and judges who don't try many death penalty cases, and they're getting less and less. And in every case, you're going to find some small error that, under your standard, would throw the case out, require it to be tried all over again. Doesn't there have to be some sort of test that the error has to be fundamental to the trial to make a difference?
Well, Justice Stratton, I would agree with you. There does have to be some type of error which is fundamental, and I believe that there does have to be some type of standard, but I think Strickland is flawed because it gives us two different types of standards to operate from. For example, Strickland says, as you recall, that notwithstanding the bifurcated analysis of deficiency and prejudice, the court need not follow that procedure. The court can go automatically to prejudice if it wishes and forget the deficiency. And if it can't stand the outcome determinative test under prejudice, the defendant or the appellant loses. Now that's the outcome's error which Strickland allows. However, if that's the case, why then does Justice O'Connor write that the result of a proceeding is reliable, so finality concerns are somewhat weaker and the appropriate standard of prejudice should be somewhat lower. The result of the proceeding can be rendered unreliable and hence the proceeding itself unfair, even if the errors of counsel cannot be shown.
You have to really look at that statement in context of the particular error she was analyzing to really understand what she was talking about. If you take that statement in the abstract, you can make that argument, but don't you have to look at what is exactly the error she was analyzing in that particular section to see what she was talking about? Because it could be a very different type of error than the Strickland standard applied to earlier.
It can be, but it follows immediately prior to the second standard of Strickland, and it follows immediately to the standard that you can go immediately to an outcome determinative test.
Counsel, what standard are you proposing that we employ here? What would be the appropriate review?
I think the appropriate review is to show that the errors were deficient, and the errors were so deficient and egregious that they would allow to demonstrate the unreliability of the process and the unfairness of the process, and thus allow for the fundamental type of error that Justice was talking about, in that here were attorneys who didn't know the law. Here's where attorneys who fashioned an argument.
How do you distinguish between an attorney who really may not have a whole lot to work with and puts forth maybe a flawed defense legally, but that might be the only thing they have to work with, as opposed to a defense that is fundamentally flawed, as you state, that and that being the only test? How do you balance that?
Well, I don't have a lot to work with in this argument, Judge, but I'm not making arguments to you that are contrary to law and contrary to the decisions of this court. I would be incompetent in that.
You're talking right now post-trial, and you're arguing the standard as being inappropriate and you would like us to write a law to that effect. Putting yourself in the place of the attorney at the trial table, there are instances that you would have to agree where, and not necessarily in capital cases only, where an attorney doesn't have a whole lot to work with given the evidence that the state has developed and statements made by the defendant themselves.
That's
How do you
true.
Balance that?
That's true, and I would agree with that. And that's probably the case in most capital cases. That's probably the case. But I don't think that in any way gives license or excuse or justification for an attorney being incompetent or not knowing the law and fashioning these types of arguments. I guess another way of asking the question is, well, Mr. Lager, if you were trial counsel, what would you have done under these type of circumstances? I certainly wouldn't have offered the defense that you can't have robbery and burglary contrary to this court's decisions. What I would have done, however, is I would have objected to prosecutorial misconduct. I would have objected to the judicial errors. I would not have sat on my hands. I would have preserved appeal. I would have probably devoted most of my time to a more serious and effective mitigation defense as opposed to following something that I knew just to be absolute frivolous and wrong. And I think that's the responsibility of capital litigators at the trial phase. These people just didn't meet it, and it was the same as if Mr. Jackson sat there by himself. Your Honors, I see that I'm out of time. I have 7.5 minutes left, and I thank you for your question.
Should there be sanctions for counsel who conduct themselves in this fashion, in your view?
I think so, Justice O'Donnell. I think that the people who are so lacking in their abilities should, at the very least, be removed as capital litigators. They have no business in representing people charged with death penalty specifications when they are so ill-equipped to offer appropriate and legal defenses, as was done in Mr. Jackson's case.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lager. Is Mr. Lasko going to take rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Mr. Watkins.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Chief Justice, Your Honors. May it please the court. I've been county prosecutor for approximately 20 years. I've tried probably 20 capital cases. Many of them have been against attorneys Lewis and Consolding. The record reflects a double homicide where they saved a man's life in State versus Schaefer. It is an unusual position that as prosecutor I'm going to defend counsel because the counsel needs to be defended. I think the record in this case establishes two things. One, and has been brought out by one of the justices, seldom does a prosecutor go into court with as much evidence as the state had in this case. That is, sometimes the evidence is so overwhelming there is no defense. And I have sympathy when the facts are stacked on one side's behalf to counsel on the other side. I'm going to do my job, and I'm going to sometimes overkill with the evidence. But in this particular case, as the court is aware, from a review of the record, there are approximately 700 exhibits, including 19 tape conversations between the two defendants in their conspiring to kill the victim.
Counsel, I'm interested in exactly where you're going. My limited time here, I have never heard such a vicious attack on defense counsel as we've just listened to.
I agree.
I have a hard time believing anyone could be as incompetent as Mr. Lager has indicated. It was an extremely strong and I think inappropriate attack based on the record. But let me ask you this. He gave us a scenario that seemed to me to be on what limited facts I read Alice in Wonderland kind of approach to what happened. What was the prosecution's proof to the jury as to how this defendant got to the house, first of all? What was your theory? I realize you had his statement about
in his last conversation, which was admitted, was between Donna Roberts at the Lorain Correction Center. He indicated that he needed, and it also included at least two letters, he needed gloves, handcuffs, and that he was going to go to the house, but it wasn't going to happen there. The evidence supported our theory that he was to be taken, killed probably in Youngstown, and the evidence wouldn't be inferred. Obviously, the wife, who really wasn't the wife, I referred to the wife, the ex-wife, had to make the 9/11 call.
Okay, well, let me stop you there. Was it your theory and what you presented to the jury that that he went to the Greyhound station and rode to the house with the victim?
No. That is absolutely contrary to the...
So your theory was, and what you presented to the jury in terms of evidence, was he was hiding in the house?
Oh, correct.
Yeah.
And we had two witnesses that contradicted his story that he went to Youngstown.
And your evidence would have been, I assume, that she dropped him off.
Absolutely.
All right.
And there were phone call conversations immediately after the shooting between two portables,
right,
which we had phone records right at that period of time between 9:30 and 10 o'clock.
So the reality of what the defense attorneys had to work with is, A, his confession or whatever you call it, where he claims it was self-defense.
And that's
correct. His story, which he stuck to. He never deviated from that. Is that correct?
He stuck to it.
All right. So now they're in the situation where they're having to defend a guy who is giving this story to the police. He's sticking with it. And they've got some choices to make. Do they try to disavow that story and to work with the facts as you are presenting them, or do they have to defend this case sticking with that story? That's problem number one for them, is it not?
I think that the story made no sense, and that put them in a quandary. And if I could get to the issues that I feel just aren't sustained by the record, the fact of the matter is that counsel refers to the idea that an instruction by a court relative to the fact that Nate Jackson was invited into the home by the owner of the home, that since there wasn't ownership and there was an invitation, Therefore, he couldn't commit aggravated burglary. It's contrary to law, but I thought it was smart on, with nothing to work with, it created a problem. In fact, in my argument, I said this is a diversion. I would say the I would say he went home. No, it's not
his
home.
Counsel, it's contrary to law in terms of reading this court's opinions, but I, on the other hand, as you know, have been critical of prosecutors who go for the death.
I know, Your Honor. I've read your opinions.
In cases exactly like this, where it's a lover's deal, the purpose, I mean, what appears to me that you proved is in conspiracy with her, he's hiding there with the purpose of taking this man's life. Maybe not at the house, and probably things got out of hand, and that's why the mess is all at the house. But he went there with a plan of murder. He didn't go there with a plan of robbery or burglary or taking the car or anything else. That all happened when things went awry. And as you know, I've written a number of times saying that's, to me, that's really not what the statute was intended to cover. So I'm having a hard time understanding. I realize these defense attorneys have six other justices to convince, or three more, but on that kind of an argument, they've probably got me, and they know that going in. Would that be a fair statement of how you read the cases?
Well, when in my mind, this is the most serious of aggravated burglaries one could commit. I don't think a person can consent to allow someone to come in and kill a person and then in fact take his vehicle for, in this instance, for insurance proceeds. To say that that this isn't a aggravating circumstance that merits the death penalty, in my opinion, virtually no aggravating circumstance involving aggravated burglary would ever merit the death penalty. You have
so the you offered evidence that taking the car was part of the plan as well.
And that's correct.
To collect.
I mean, he was going to kidnap the man from his home. I mean, this man just worked all day. He comes home, this guy's in the kitchen, and shoots him three times, one right in the top of the head.
Yeah.
He didn't know what was coming. And no person should be in a situation where they're going to go home and someone could, by surreptition, go into the house and kill him. And as far as this novel argument...
Okay, let me stop you. You think that'd be a death penalty offense?
Of course.
If the wife, girlfriend, leaves her lover in the house for the purpose of just killing the old man when he comes home, that's a death case?
That's absolutely a death case.
How?
Because there is no way that a co-owner can consent against another owner of the home or a resident of the home, in this case an occupant, to allow a murder to occur.
Where do you get the death spec?
The death spec is aggravated burglary and aggravated robbery. I mean,
if he's there just for the purpose of killing him?
He chose to kill the man in his home. He chose to go in surreptitious as to that occupant of the resident and to intentionally take his life. In fact, in this instance, it was the first charge of prior calculation and design.
And you've got that. I mean, got that in spades.
Well, you have an aggravated burglary and you have an aggravated robbery.
So the burglary is the wife letting him in the house?
No, the burglary is that this is his home. He trespassed as to this man's residence, and that the instruction of the court specifically dealt with that a trespasser, a person who's committed an unlawful act, cannot have consent. You can't be, in my opinion, the construction of the law is pretty clear.
You can be a trespasser as to one owner and there with consent of the other owner at the same time?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And I think as far as...
Now, in your case, you're saying you have more because you you offered evidence that there was a plan to take the automobile along with the killing, that it wasn't an afterthought to
just get
out of there when the thing went
south. He was dropped off. He had to get out of that house.
Right.
And the vehicle was available. That is his 300M, Chrysler 300M. But the fact that, getting to counsel, that there is a novel argument made by defense counsel relative to the fact that he didn't own the home, that in their brief they make arguments that the death penalty is unconstitutional. And time and time again, we will have defense counsel arguing propositions of law that have been ruled upon by this court. It's been done in this case. So the fact that attorneys Lewis and Constantine make novel presentations is, in my opinion, not incompetence. And in fact, I think they fought like hell. Excuse me. They objected whenever they could. And each one of these errors, if you look at the record and the brief of the appellee, I think the record does not substantiate any of the errors that have been claimed today.
Counsel, would you direct your attention to the request of the appellants here to abandon Strickland for the purposes of review and impose a test that would measure gross incompetence as all that is necessary, whatever the definition would be of gross incompetence, if it's subjective or how we are to look at that. Would you comment on that, please?
Well, I think Strickland, which was decided in 1984, has a solid basis in law. And I think there has to be cause and prejudice. I think in this case, it's a slippery slope. I don't see the record of incompetence here. I think this was an unnecessary attack on counsel who has tried many, many cases. I think it's a case where the evidence is evidence beyond all doubt, and counsel for the defense had no choice. I don't agree that that we have a need of any change of the constitutional strictures here in Ohio on this issue.
Counsel, if I could direct you to our last capital case that talked about Strickland, State versus Hoffner. We make a statement that Strickland requires the defendant show first that counsel's performance was deficient, and second, that counsel's deficient performance prejudiced the defense so as to deprive the defendant of a fair trial. You think that satisfies this particular case?
In this case, I don't see from the record my questioning on voir dire. I've done this for years. I don't, to be quite frank about it, I never extracted any promise from anybody, from any of the jurors. I simply did what defense counsel does and tried to determine whether or not this juror, if I prove my case beyond a reasonable doubt with all the evidence in the law, would you and could you return a verdict of guilty, or would you or could you impose a death penalty? We do that every day. These complaints are not valid. And they certainly, I say they aren't deficient. And secondly, there's no prejudice here. Nothing that he has presented shows prejudice in light of the totality of the evidence. It's just overwhelming.
He's attacking your office for prosecutorial misconduct. Did you want to address that?
I'm sorry?
If I understand Mr. Lager's position, there are several, as many as 8 or 10 instances of alleged prosecutorial misconduct, both with respect to the conduct of the voir dire, the opening statement, the final argument with respect to the penalty phase. Did you want to address that?
Yes, Your Honor. I would say that the questioning of the jurors, that I didn't exact any promises. So there was nothing I asked any of the jurors that was wrong. And I think our brief addresses that. There's much made of, at least two different assignments of error, that I used the word, this is a diversion. Yeah, I did. And I'm trying to argue my case in line with the evidence and the law that Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, it really doesn't matter if this man owned a vehicle. They brought in evidence of title as to the vehicle he was driving, which was in his wife's name. They brought in evidence that the home was in the wife's name, that this wasn't the man's home. So I had to argue. I said, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, this is a diversion. I mean, let's look at the real evidence and listen to the law. Under 29-1301, owner includes occupant. Owner includes the residence. There are many of us that give our children their car to drive, the titles in our name, to say, well, we don't have a crime against the owner. It doesn't make it less of a crime. This is what I had to deal with during the case, during final argument. These are some of the examples, Justice O'Donnell, that they're complaining about. And each one we address in our brief saying, so what? One, it's not error. Two, if it is error, it's de minimis. And they cite Keenan. Keenan's a case this court decided where the prosecutor said it's a hired gun to get the guy off. They called the defendant an animal. The state did none of that. There is nothing in the record that establishes there was any egregious conduct on part of the prosecution. And so when you have nothing, you attack everyone. And I think that's what's been done here today. There is nothing in this case. This was a fair trial. The defendant got his just deserts. And as far as in the rebuttal part of the trial, the penalty phase, excuse me, counsel makes a big thing out of the fact is mental disease and defect. Well, they presented Sandra McPherson as a mitigation expert. She went into attention deficit disorder. She went into antisocial personality disorder. She went into 70 IQ. So then I go into it. Wait, you're not saying there's any mental disease or defect. I'm entitled to cross-examination of any witness that they present issues that are relevant. I want the jury to understand that these are personality disorders and don't deserve the kind of mitigating weight that, for example, mental retardation would have or psychosis would have. I'm doing my job. And they're claiming I did something wrong. I did nothing wrong. And that's what I'm saying. I look at this, and I went through this brief. I talked to my co-counsel. I said, I don't see anything here. This man had a fair trial. I think we did a darn good job. And I think defense counsel, with what they had to work with, did the best they could.
Counsel, there was a point brought up about the authentication of the documents, the letters, the conspiratorial evidence that were found in the possession or under the control of the ex-wife.
Okay.
And the fact that the defendant's letters were authenticated using an expert, hers were not.
I believe it's 901.
Pardon me?
Dealing with admissibility of documents. We have to show it's probable, the document. We don't have to show it's conclusive. There are tape conversations dealing with the fact that these two individuals were corresponding. The letters that were from Donna to Nate were found in the car the day, 2 days after he got out of prison with his clothes, according to the evidence. His clothes is with the letters. He refers to writing in his own statement. This evidence, Donna admitted that the letters to the police officers during the course of the search, that they were her letters of the vehicle. There was ample circumstantial evidence to provide a foundation. It's beyond belief that letters found in her vehicle with her signature and with conversation on admissible tape recordings and video referring to the documents does not provide sufficient foundation. I submit without question, in my opinion, the court was, I don't even think there was an objection. It was so clear.
Well, so you're saying that their failure to cite that or to object on the record, et cetera, is not a sign of incompetence or failure to zealously represent their client.
Well, I think you make a, I would hate to think that if a defense attorney doesn't object when there is ample evidence support a given proposition, that now he's going to be ruled incompetent or inefficient, and they'll be objecting to everything we do in court. Because, well, if I don't object, even though there's no basis. Now, at times, you're going to object, depending on the scenario and your thinking, and we have to be given some leeway as trial attorneys. We can't be put in a straitjacket and try these cases. And I think courts have to realize that I've been doing this for years. I've tried 44 murder cases, and I make mistakes at times. And I've tried to be professional, and I think I've established a reputation with the court that we're fair in Trumbull County. And I know that defense counsel, I have a very good relationship with the public defender, and they work hard for their clients. I don't believe that in this instance, in fact, the defense in final argument used some of Donna's letters to say, Donna, for example, wrote, "Nate, you really don't have the courage to do this." And so he used some of the letters for his own purposes, trying to save his life in the penalty phase.
Counsel, this is just a question, and I don't know that it really has any relevance here, but aren't those letters monitored by the Department of Corrections when they come in? Are prisoners' letters?
No, they can with suspicion, but there's people get letters all the time.
So there is no monitoring, but their phone conversations. Obviously, they were taped.
There is monitoring, but the chances that they'll overhear something are very limited. There are literally thousands of phone calls. We covered that. The State Patrol provided the witnesses relative to the documentation of the recordings. On each recording, it says you are at Lorain Correctional and what you are saying will be recorded. Now, in hindsight, you would say this is pretty stupid, you know, that they're talking about killing this man. And in fact, they even went into some graphic detail how she wanted to be present when he was murdered. It was incredible. And it was truly pornographic in some of the letters. And if he wouldn't have been shot when he shot himself in the struggle trying to take the man, he shot his finger, there's a good chance we wouldn't have gotten to those conversations. We got a break. This homeowner put up a struggle. If he would have been found by where he worked in Youngstown, the evidence trail would have been different. And we had seven agencies, and we got to the taped conversations in time and subpoenaed them. And
so basically they tape all of these, but they don't necessarily listen to them to know ahead of time that there's a plot in action.
Right. If they would have listened to them, then they could have stopped this. But they monitor very, they just can't, there's thousands of calls made by hundreds of, and they can't monitor every conversation. There are no other questions. I have nothing further. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Watkins. Mr. Lasko, Mr. Logger saved you just about 7 minutes.
Counsel, would you address the fact made by Mr. Watkins that defense counsel here, this was not their first capital case. And in fact, they had not only been death penalty certified, but had had successes in the past with representation of other defendants with murder charges.
Your Honor, I think that's the fact of the matter that makes this all the more unbelievable with respect to how they went about representing this particular defendant in this case. The fact that they did have the experience of participating in other criminal capital cases, that they were able to have some success in those cases, but yet the actions of what they did in this particular case were just completely below the standards that require a capital defendant for purposes of guaranteeing that he gets a fair trial and effective assistance of counsel. The difference, I think, in what counsel tried to point out with was that we put forth arguments in our brief that we know you have decided before. We know the difference between what this court will accept and what the standard is. We do, as appellate attorneys, different things than trial counsel do. Trial counsel's job is to maintain the decorum, to preserve the issues for appeal, for review, for purposes of later reviewing these items. Our arguments, or our position, is to maintain arguments even though we know what the history of this court is with respect to certain issues, such as the unconstitutionality of the death penalty statute, for purposes of federal review and habeas and things of that down the line. What counsel did in this case was put forth a defense which the most minute research would have indicated could not have been used or could not have been argued. And I think that's the major difference with respect to their performance.
Did he not also, or they, not proceed with a self-defense?
Mr. Jackson did not testify as far as self-defense. That argument was made. Again, it wasn't the overriding specific type of argument that they made for purposes.
Well, if Mr. Jackson didn't take the stand to articulate the need for self-defense, and it was out there on the periphery based on his statements to the police, that there was a conversation, he was there at the home legitimately,
right,
and a problem arose with the victim. The victim attacked him, you know, took a gun out, was attacking him, and he managed to wrestle it away from him and shoot the aggressor, the homeowner. Without the testimony of the defendant to articulate that,
it would have pretty much been a worthless defense.
Would have been a worthless defense. Okay, so here we are again presented with an example of the defense being stymied by the defendant.
Or not having any other evidence to articulate in order to substantiate that particular thing. And I think that may have gone to a tactical decision depending upon what evidence was available to them.
Wasn't that the key here, the tactical defense and the decisions made by defense attorneys representing the defendant at the trial level?
Failing to object to misconduct of the prosecutor, failing to object to violations of pretrial rulings, specifically limiting certain evidence to be presented to a jury, failing to object when improper comments are being made regarding evidence, I don't think, Judge, rises to the level of a tactical decision. Those are errors of ineffective assistance of counsel. These errors are magnified when the court looks at the rulings and the procedures that the judge employed when some of these items were brought to the court's attention. When the issue of Prosecutor Watkins referring to the mental disease or defect in the final argument and the mitigation hearing, and there was a discussion as to that, the court neither made a decision regarding counsel's objection nor gave any curative instructions. In fact, as set forth on page 38 of our brief, the judge says that he, in front of the jury, anything that you said up to this point I don't think was improper, but please continue. And then the court, without deciding the objection or enforcing the order, allows Prosecutor Watkins to continue asking the questions regarding mental disease and defect. Again, we're going back to the issue of we have the prosecutor had specific knowledge that mental disease and defect was not an issue that was going to be brought up in mitigation, yet he used, during cross-examination, to his advantage, after having set that up during voir dire, the opportunity to bring this evidence to the jurors to show there wasn't this mitigating evidence, which he got them to agree in the beginning would be one of the things to substantiate a not guilty verdict or a guilty verdict.
And you can look at it that way, or according to Mr. Watkins' explanation, it was to distinguish between the testimony by the expert discussing deficit disorder, IQ level, personality disorders, as opposed to a psychosis or a mental retardation or one other condition that would qualify as a mitigating factor. So to clarify that in the mind of the jury is not improper, correct?
I would say this, Your Honor. This was probably a situation where counsel for the state took control over the actions and the functions of what was going on. Counsel for the defendant stood by, did nothing to prevent him from doing and setting the course that was put forth. The court did nothing to make sure that Mr. Jackson received a fair trial regarding these particular issues, and the cumulative effect of everything that we've set forth in these three assignments of error is the basis for our request that he should receive a new trial and that this case, the decision should be reversed as far as the death sentence goes.
Thank you, Mr. Lasko. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.